This is Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. And the place we're taking you today is Hollywood, old Hollywood, or maybe new Hollywood, quintessential Hollywood.
I like the tall ceilings, I like the deep red booths, and I like to look on people's faces when they come in here. You know, it's like they're in a museum, like a half museum, and half of, it just has a magical look. People are very excited to be here, and we're excited to have them, you know.
It's a restaurant, you probably heard of it. It's where you go for a steak, or a martini, or maybe even a trip back in time.
Out in Radio Land, you can't see this, but late at night, the shadows start to stretch a little bit, and it's a warm, inviting, it's like, let's not go out, let's go to Musso and Frank's. Like, in town, it has that feeling that you're home, and it's in a spirit. It's like in a spirit world where you feel it. You don't necessarily see it, but you feel it when you walk in here.
That's Kenneth Sonny Donato, Musso and Frank bartender who's waxing poetic about his workplace. Tomorrow, that Hollywood landmark celebrates its 100th birthday. Well, sandwiched between a vape shop and a margarita watering hole on Hollywood Boulevard, Musso and Frank Grill remains almost completely untouched by time. So how has it survived the constant cultural upheaval of Los Angeles? KCRW's Angel Carreras went out for a classic martini to find out.
It's a busy lunch hour here at Musso and Frank's. Waiters in red dinner jackets zoom past each other, bringing food to people's tables. They drop off a corned beef and cabbage at a booth. It's the one the Rolling Stones like to sit at. But today sitting there is a salt and pepper haired actor with a face you'd recognize. Family of eight, sitting at a table, looks at the actor, but doesn't gawk. Respectful. They place their order and tell their server they've been patrons for years.
General vibe in here is sovereignty. People have, we give everybody a lot of respect. And we honor, we cherish our guests, you know. We treat celebrities like normal people and normal people like celebrities.
The restaurant has, throughout its history, attracted the Hollywood elite, the literati, salt of the earth Angelenos. But surprisingly, not tourists.
Even though we're on Hollywood Boulevard, we do very little tourist traffic, to be honest. It's mainly Angeleno, local Angeleno, that come in and support us day in and day out, year in and year out, 100 years and year out. So, you know, we just keep it very authentic to what we do. We don't try to get cute. We just want people to know that they can come to Musso's, get the same meal, the same experience that they did 60 years ago.
That's fourth generation Musso and Frank owner Mark Echevarria. He says the secret to gaining LA's trust for so many years is the same secret to their enduring daily specials. Don't change a thing.
Nothing's going to change. You know, it's not like you turn 100 and then all of a sudden you reinvent the wheel and you keep going. We're in the best year we've ever had. We've had more people come and experience this restaurant this year than ever. So why change anything? So our next 100 years, yeah, we're kicking off 100 years, but we're not changing a thing.
And it's true. They haven't changed much. From the English countryside wallpaper to Musso's menu. For instance, Thursday's daily special, the popular chicken pot pie, hasn't been touched since 1922, aside from switching to GMO-free chickens. Even the chef changes at Musso's only occur because, well, no one can outlive Musso's. The current chef, JP Amato, is a newbie by Musso standards. He's been there 9 years.
He's the third executive chef ever in the history of the restaurant, third in 100 years. He did a really remarkable job of looking at the recipes, bringing them up to a modern-day palate without ruining the historical integrity of what that recipe was intended to do.
And then there's the martini.
It's dry, it's silky, it's stirred, never shaken. James Bond got it wrong. I hate to say that because I love James Bond, but he got it wrong. It's stirred, not shaken. And it's just a really silky taste. We serve it in a very small martini glass with a little sidecar that's chilled on ice. So no matter what point you're at through your cocktail, it's always going to be nice, crisp, and cold, which a martini should be.
Another thing that makes this place last is, well, really just how long it's lasted. Frank Toulet and Joseph Musso first opened the restaurant's seafoam green doors in 1919, a time when LA had fewer than 600,000 people living here. The restaurant switched hands to Echevarria's family in the 1930s. Business began to boom, just as Hollywood did.
When you walk in, old Hollywood just reeks.
That's Allison Martino. She's a writer, producer, and historian, She's got a house full of old Hollywood relics she's collected and shows them off on Instagram. Naturally, she's a Musso and Frank regular. She grew up in the restaurant.
You know, you can, like, smell Cary Grant's cigar smoke on the wallpaper, you know, or the original wood paneling in the main room. And they have the oldest phone booth in Hollywood. The oldest phone booth in Hollywood. And you just can't think of any, you know, I think of, like, John Barrymore made calls from there, and John Huston and Betty Davis, and, you know, I think of Charlie Chaplin and how he would walk his horses up and down Hollywood Boulevard, and then he sat in that one little booth with the only window. You know, you could look out, you could see the horses. Now that's the most requested booth, you know, and the Steve McQueen chair that he swirled around in.
It wasn't just movie stars. Names like Hemingway, Faulkner, and Bukowski, who had a memorable fight with Steve McQueen, would all scrawl their latest books at Musso's Mahogany Bar, or in one of the blood-red booths, ordering Cuba Libres or bourbon and sodas. The clientele also helped attract the staff.
Hey, you know what? I read a lot of Raymond Chandler. I read every, and I know every character in his book, and I know the authors and the literary LA legacy that's here, and I love it. So, you know, I didn't just happen to, you know, come here. I brought my resume here after I retired for 12 years, and I decided to restart my career here at Musso & Frank's.
Some staff are throwbacks to an era when waiters and bartenders were in it for the long haul, not just waiting for the next big break. Some have worked here for decades, while others are fairly new, like waiter Jonathan Cohen, who was drawn to the restaurant 4 years ago. He spent 8 years at Tam O'Shanter, another classic LA restaurant, before coming to Musso's.
All these restaurants, there's not a lot left in Los Angeles. There's us, there's Tam, there's Pacific Dining Car, Philippe's and Cole's, but that's it. We have a tendency in LA to tear things down without knowing about what it's going to mean in the future, and put up these, you know, shopping malls and things like that. And I like the old history, and I hope Musso stays around forever, and I hope everything else that's up right now stays around forever.
Now that it's lasted this long, it's hard to imagine what could put them out of business. During World War II, there was food rationing. There's been earthquakes. Just last week, a pipe burst in the restaurant, flooding a planned room expansion and the kitchen. The restaurant only closed one weekend.
Musso and Frank will live on way beyond you and me, you know, way beyond. I mean, they will survive another 100 years for sure.
And for anybody with gentrification fears, worry not. The restaurant owners also own the land it's on and have no plans to sell. For KCRW, I'm Angel Carreras.
Well, coming up, California health officials are out with new warnings about vaping. And the bottom line is they want you to stop. It's Greater LA on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're back with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. If you have a vape pen in your hand, put it down right now. That's what California health officials are saying. And the LA County Board of Supervisors voted this week to move forward on a ban of the sale of flavored tobacco in unincorporated parts of LA County. And today, City Attorney Mike Feuer announced a $1.5 million public outreach campaign to deter young people from using vape products.
The FDA has to act right now. In the meantime, we have to act right now because the stakes are really high.
Now, all this comes amid a national outbreak of severe lung disease suspected to be linked to vaping. So far, there have even been 11 deaths, including two right here in California, one in the LA area. But it is tough to get people to change their habits.
I understand it's a new technology, so the side effects are starting to show up, and they're going to continue to show up, but I don't think, you know, there needs to be a ban on it or anything, because there are plenty more harmful things that we can put bans on.
Michael Ung is a doctor at UCLA. He heads up the Tobacco Education and Research Oversight Committee for the state of California. Dr. Ung, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
It might seem a bit rudimentary, but what is the difference between smoking a cigarette and vaping?
So with cigarette smoking, we've been able to study traditional cigarettes for more than 50 years now to understand what those health harms are. With these new type of electronic smoking devices, which people know as electronic cigarettes and vaping devices, we really don't know a lot about these new types of technologies. They do change quite frequently, and so when we do scientific studies on certain types of products, other products come onto the market or people start using other types of devices. And particularly with flavors, I think what is most concerning is that because we don't really have a lot of regulation, very few of the flavoring chemicals that are used in these devices have undergone adequate toxicity or safety testing for inhalation. And so this is not just something that is, let's say, just nicotine and water vapor. There's a lot of different types of chemicals that are in solvents that would potentially go into these products so that they would provide the type of flavorings that people are looking to use. And so that may be part of the problem that we have been seeing with the vaping-associated lung injury cases here in California and across the country.
What do we know, doctor, about the people who are getting these lung ailments and diseases? And the people who have died, they're younger than your typical cigarette smoker, right?
That is true. And that's part of the reason why we're very surprised at what we see. I mean, these are individuals who are otherwise very healthy.
We don't even know what these ingredients are because they're not required to release them, right?
There have been requests for people to start submitting that type of information to the Food and Drug Administration, but this is still very early. And so when we think about other types of products where we find problems with, let's say, meat products or toys that cause harm, we have product recalls. We don't really have that option with these type of products that we don't really have a lot of information on. So I think at this point, it seems like the safest thing is to put a stop to it while we figure out what actually has happened with these cases that we've seen over across the country.
Well, easier said than done, right? Because, I mean, we are creatures of habit. I want to play a bit of tape from Stephen Boynton. He's 29 years old, smoking cigarettes since he was 18. He recently switched to vaping, and now he's trying to quit vaping.
This doesn't mean that, like, nicotine is good or that, you know, any individual should pick up vaping, but it seems to my mind that it is ultimately harm reductive, that it is better to consume nicotine in this form.
And I want to allude back again to the difference between smoking and vaping. Is the vapor better for you, do you think? I mean, is there sort of is there a miscalculation going on here?
While it may seem cleaner, and again, many people equate vapor with water vapor or maybe there's nicotine in it, but there's a lot of other things that go into it. And I think that the studies that have looked at the vapor show that there are other types of chemicals that are also in those type of products. And when we think about what potentially can happen, several years ago, the New England Journal of Medicine reported on vaping products that produced acrolein, which is the same type of chemical that causes popcorn lung. And that happened because the devices heated the chemicals up to a certain level for things like glycerin and propylene glycol that are often used in these type of vaping products to simulate the smoke that you would see with the water vapor. And as a result of that high heat, it generated acrolein, which then caused damage to people's lungs. And I think that when we look at the range of type of devices that are out there, when people are doing things on their own without a lot of product regulation, it's really hard for us to say what type of chemicals are being created that may or may not be carcinogenic.
And it is a lot of young people who are vaping, right?
That's true. I think that some of the things that are most concerning are how many young individuals are using these type of products. And so last year in Los Angeles County, 83% of high school students who used a tobacco product in the past 30 days used a flavored tobacco product. And so when we think about what people are using at this point, and particularly among young individuals who may not know very much or may not know better, I think it's just important to, again, try to protect those individuals and minimize the potential harms to them.
So all that flavored tobacco, I think, has not been lost on L.A. County supervisors who are planning to ban the sale of flavored tobacco in unincorporated areas. Do you think an all-out ban will widen the black market and then people will find other ways, less safe, less regulated ways to get these products?
I think that from a precautionary standpoint, it's just a better idea to probably halt for now while we get a better sense of how to proceed forward.
Do you think manufacturers at some point will be required to release a list of their ingredients? To my knowledge, I don't think cigarette companies even do that, right?
So that is something that the Food and Drug Administration can do at this point, but they also probably need to go further. It's one thing to list the ingredients. It's another thing altogether to be able to demonstrate that safety. And I think that this is where we need more science to understand the types of materials and chemicals that are being placed into these type of products that previously may have been tested for ingestion that would have been safe. But again, since we haven't done those type of testing for inhalation of these same type of products, it is really difficult to say that these are really safe for inhalation use.
You're the head of the state's Tobacco Education and Research Oversight Committee, so you play a role in this. What's next for you?
I think that you will probably see more of these type of regulations coming through local areas, in large part because the federal process takes a long time. So it's one thing to say that the federal government is looking to potentially act and put a ban on these type of products sometime in the near future. But again, given how the federal processes tend to work, electronic cigarette regulation was originally proposed by the Food and Drug Administration back in 2011, 8 years ago. So I think that it's important for local areas to act now. And I think that that's something that you're seeing both at the local levels here in Los Angeles and in Los Angeles County, as well as at the state level, while I think everyone is trying to make sure that we create a safe environment for everyone.
Dr. Michael Ong over at UCLA. Doctor, thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Well, coming up next, horse racing is out of the starting gate tomorrow at Santa Anita. Still so many questions about the horses that died last season. You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. The new horse racing season begins on Friday at Santa Anita, a track that's been embroiled in controversy. At least 30 horses had to be put down at the track last year, which was more than had been seen in recent years. Couple that with the fact that a horse that would go on to win the Triple Crown, Justify, failed a drug test at the track, and there are more questions than answers as the new season gets underway. Even California Governor Gavin Newsom has commented on the track and horse racing in general. Joe Drape covers the intersection of sports and culture and money for the New York Times, and he's with us right now. Hi, Joe.
Steve, how are you?
I'm well. I want to set up the backstory here for people who have not been following the story. Tell us exactly what happened with Justify, the horse that won the Triple Crown. And I'm talking about, obviously, we're talking about the Kentucky Derby and Belmont and Preakness Stakes.
Justify failed a drug test, a doping test, at the Santa Anita Derby about a month before the Derby, Kentucky Derby in 2018. He was in that race and he had to finish first or second to punch his ticket to Kentucky. By rules of California, the failed test should have disqualified him, should have returned the purse money, and he should not have been able to go on to the Kentucky Derby. He would not have qualified. All this came to light in reporting I did last week. What had happened was he flunked the test. They slow walked it up to the months leading into the Derby. They waited 2 weeks to tell Bob Baffert. Bob Baffert, as his right, asked for a split sample to confirm the findings. He did. That didn't come back until Justify had already won the Kentucky Derby. And then at that point, it disappears. There's a memo that I obtained from the director to the commissioners saying, hey, we're going to file a complaint and schedule a hearing. That's on May 8th. Never happens. He wins the Preakness. He wins the Belmont. He gets sold his breeding rights for $60 million. All of a sudden, April 23rd, they go to behind closed doors, the commissioners of the California Horse Racing Board, their chairman. He owns horses, and Baffert had trained him. They go behind closed doors and make it disappear. So that's what happened on Justify.
Baffert is what, the owner of Justify?
He is the trainer. He's probably the most famous trainer in America. He won the Triple Crown, which is a hard thing to do, Steve. Only 13 in history had done so. He did it in 2015 with a horse named American Pharoah, and American Pharoah was the first one to sweep the series since affirmed in 1978. So it's a big deal.
This of course, Joe, is on top of 30 horses that died at Santa Anita last season. Are they any closer at the track or at the horse racing board or wherever to finding out what happened?
There is a investigation by the Los Angeles Attorney Office, and we're waiting to see what they find out. In the meantime, all the vet records and the necropsies have been locked up. We will see Friday what Santa Anita's done to improve their safety record when they open their new meet. But no, the short answer, Steve, is nobody knows what happened to those horses. Nobody knows what's going to happen here. It's not been a good year for horse racing in general and California specifically.
All right, so Governor Gavin Newsom then talks about horse racing in California, says there is this high need for reform. What exactly did he have to say, and what does he recommend?
Well, he has already appointed three commissioners that had nothing to do with horse racing directly, meaning there were no financial ties. They didn't own them. They didn't breed them. They were not the foxes in the hen house, which has been the previous protocols out there. He's got a chairmanship coming up. He says he's going to appoint somebody with no financial ties to the industry. And then, you know, he just kind of got on the bully pulpit and said it's a disgrace that if they don't reform themselves, they're going to be out of business. And at the very least, they're going to be pushed into reforms they don't want. So, you know, it's at a critical point out there.
Well, all right, notwithstanding these members that he appointed, what did the horse racing board, what kind of relationship did they have to the industry itself before, and what kind of issues did they have before the board? What are we talking about here?
Well, they are owners and breeders of horses. Bob Baffert was one of their employees. Bob Baffert bred a horse with the co-chairman, Madeline Arbach, out there. Basically, their job was to enforce the rules and to regulate them. So Bob Baffert or the jockeys or the several trainers that they all employed would get in trouble or there'd be some violations, and they had to be the judge and the jury on it.
When I was reading your article, I learned, and this is an extraordinary number, but as many as 10 horses die every week at racetracks across the country.
Yeah, Stephen, that's a conservative number. I mean, that is not including training deaths and deaths that happen after they leave the racetrack, like in the next day or so. We did a series at the Times in 2012, and we had that number at 25 a week. So, you know, I think a lot of this is coming to the fore because people are learning how, you know, inherently dangerous the sport is. And they don't like to witness or believe that there's abuse going on. You know, I grew up with the circus. There's no circus. I grew up with SeaWorld. There's no SeaWorld. This is just a new environment.
It's a new environment, but horses, I mean, when we think of horses that are racing or running, right? I mean, that's what horses do.
Yes, they do. And, you know, it's a $15 billion industry, and people breed horses and breed thoroughbreds just to race in these kind of races. And, you know, it's an old sport. It's the oldest sport in America. It predates baseball. It's the only sport that's ever been run out of the White House. Andrew Jackson operated a stable out of there during his tenure. You know, it's a piece of history and culture that is threatened because mainly the people who are charged with protecting it haven't done a very good job.
Do you think the moves that Governor Newsom is making, especially on the California Racing Board, do you think that will make a difference in those numbers, the number of horses that die every week?
Not on the commission, but, you know, to Santa Anita's credit, to California's credit, in the wake of those deaths, they put in new protocols, new drug rules that make it a cleaner sport and a safer sport. And then they put more scrutiny, more eyes on the individual horses and trainers. They have a team of vets now who look at every horse every day, whether it be if they are just coming out to train in the morning or race in the afternoon. And, you know, it's like anything. Surveillance discourages bad behavior. And these new enhanced protocols are discouraging people from taking chances with these animals.
Joe Drape covers the intersection of sports and culture and money for the New York Times. Joe, thank you.
Thanks, Steve, for having me.
Well, that's it for today. Next week, EVs are good for the environment, but do those electric cars actually save you money, or do they drive you crazy? The Bookworms next. But before we go, a fond adieu to our producer, Catherine Barnes, who left her idyllic life in Santa Barbara to help us get our little program on the air here in Los Angeles. Catherine, I'm waving at you. You're the best. Thank you so much for everything. Thank you for tuning in, for your ear today. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Have a great day.